We have special news for you.
The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
Are you going to send me or anybody that I know to a camp?
We have people that are stupid.
Abortion, sodomy, and materialism have taken the place of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's the Ricochet Podcast with Peter Robinson and Stephen Hayward. I'm James Lilex, and today we're going to go to Paris. That's my dog. I'm James Lilex, and today we go to Paris to talk to Claire Belinsky about the Warlock Hunt. Let's have ourselves a podcast.
Bye-bye.
It's the Ricochet Podcast, post-net neutrality, so your ISP may be slowing us down just a little bit, maybe not high. It's the Ricochet Podcast number 382. It's brought to you by the fine people at Arrow. Hey, you've got high-speed internet, right? Of course you do, even post-net neutrality. And if you're tired of paying for the high-speed internet only to be frustrated by a weak Wi-Fi signal in certain parts of your home, well, there is a solution. Arrow, multi-point wireless routers, which provide a fast, reliable connection in every room, even your backyard as well. So get free overnight shipping when you order a new Arrow wireless system by going to arrow.com, E-E-R-O.com, and entering the promo code Ricochet when you check out. And we're brought to you by Casper. When you want to check out at the end of the day, oh, start sleeping ahead of the curve with a Casper. $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/ricochet and using the promo code Ricochet when you leave. And we're brought to you by Away Travel. When you leave your home, well, you know, your luggage should not cost more than your plane ticket, should it? No. So Away Travel's luggage is designed with the highest quality materials, and they're still under $300. And for $20 off that price, visit awaytravel.com/ricochet20 and use the promo code ricochet20 during your checkout. And we're brought to you by Ricochet as well. Once upon a time, Rob Long would swan in here and tell you why you had to crack open your wallet and donate a few shekels. Donate. No. Give proudly in an act of consensual commerce in order to keep Ricochet going. Well, let me just say this on Rob's behalf. A, he'll be back someday, but we'd like there to be a Ricochet when he comes back, right? And that's why, you know, we have these little fundraising drives. That's why we give you things like The Daily Shot, a free daily email newsletter. You get the day's news in a way that's easy to digest, and you get the details so you can understand what's going on in the day. It's free. We know you'll love it. And because you'll love it, you will certainly want to subscribe to ricochet.com/TDS, and you'll also want to join Ricochet. It's cheap, and it keeps going the most civil place on the internet. Yeah, there is some little scrapes now and then. Sure, there's an elbow thrown on occasion, but there's a code of conduct that keeps everybody in line and keeps and makes for a happy community that's really unique on the web. And if you've been anywhere else on the web, to YouTube, to the comments at Breitbart, you know it's a sewer out there. We're not in the sewer. We're in an alabaster palace somewhere above, looking down. Welcome, Stephen Hayward. Welcome, Peter Robinson. How are you guys in this run-up to Christmas?
We're great, James, because we can really rub it in on you people in Minnesota, because out here where Peter and I are inmates in California, it's going to be another 75-degree and sunny day.
Uh-huh. Another example of the soulless sort of rot that descends into people when the climate never changes. I'm looking at snow. I'm looking at evergreens. I'm looking at the Currier and Ives view that one is supposed to have at Christmas time. So you should envy me. Come January, I will weep. But now this is as it should be, right?
If you say so, James. Whatever you tell yourself, whatever you need to tell yourself, James. It's all right.
I do often. All right, post-Alabama, break it down. Let's. What happened here? Are we looking at a tsunami, a tidal wave, a sinking of Atlantis for the Republican Party come 2018? Was this a one-off?
Is this I'll go first because Steve will undoubtedly have more nuance and detail to offer. Here's what I think about what it says about the coming midterms in 2018. There is a high risk. There is high avalanche danger. Judge Roy Moore was a lousy candidate in all kinds of ways, but he still managed. Donald Trump had carried Alabama by, as I recall, 28 points, and Judge Roy Moore lost by 1 point, meaning there was a swing of 29 points against the Republicans in Alabama. That's not an isolation. As I say, Judge Moore was a lousy candidate. Ed Gillespie, who ran for governor of Virginia, just a couple of weeks and lost by what was it? 6 points, 9 points. It was lost by high single digits. Was a very good candidate. And on that day, not only did Ed Gillespie lose, but Republicans lost up and down the ballots in the handful, all the handful of states where special elections were taking place. Georgia, as well as I recall, two or three other states. Not major elections, but Republicans lost everywhere. My own view is that Republicans ought to be very nervous. This is not preordained. 2008, nothing is in politics, of course. 2018 is a long way away. If they get tax reform, if the economy begins, sustains the pace that it's demonstrated during the last two quarters of over 3%, if we get three quarters of over 3%, that'll be the first time in some years that that has happened. It could be a very good Republican year. But within the, let's put it this way, within the probability dispersion, a wipeout is now, to me, to my mind, a distinct possibility. Steve?
I'm not going to be able to disagree with anything you said. I think it's going to be a very grim year for Republicans for all the conventional reasons. And then the special secret sauce of Donald Trump, whom I think a lot of swing voters are going to want to cast their votes against in the midterms, just as a check on things. I'd say this about Alabama. By my reckoning, this makes the sixth Senate seat that Republicans have thrown away in the last decade, winnable seats, Senate right. seats, with bad candidates. And I think one thing to note about Alabama is you mentioned there's a 29-point swing. Moore's raw vote total was half of the raw vote total of Trump, which means a lot of people just didn't vote for him, right? They just did not come out. And you could have a depressed Republican turnout next year. We can talk about that a little bit. Now, what a lot of people say, and I think this is correct, is that, well, look, it's Alabama. Doug Jones is there, Scott Brown. We'll get the seat back in 2020 when it's up again in a general election. I think that's probably right, except what no one is pointing out right now is isn't Roy Moore going to run again in 2020? I mean, he's a stubborn and ornery guy. And I mean, of course he's going to run again. And this is a long story, but the short version is that we don't have party machines anymore. And gosh, I wish we could get them back so we could clear the field. But I think Alabama Republicans right now ought to think long term about how to keep that guy out and get somebody better to get that seat back in 2020.
I should mention, in case I didn't, that Stephen Hayward, who's joining us this week, and get this, not only is he a contributor at Powerline, a great blog that is located right here in Minnesota, of course, the epicenter of conservative thought, but he's also at Berkeley. Now, let's talk about
right.
The rest of the country, people are saying that Roy Moore is now the face of the Republican Party, regardless of whether or not he won, because they sent him money. Donald Trump endorsed him. So when the people say, you know, people look at the right and accuse us of being homophobic and being weird about race and being, strange about women's role in the workplace and all that. Now, all of a sudden, we've spent money and endorsed a guy who has all of those ideas, which are virtually, literally a caricature of what conservatives truly believe. Yet they never hang around the left, the various curiosities, intellectual and otherwise, that you see at Berkeley. Somehow what they say is never a definition of the left. It's just a strange sort of hothouse, curious side note that has nothing to do with the movement of the Democrats today. Why is that?
Well, look, I mean, what's the old line that if liberals didn't have double standards, they wouldn't have any standards at all? I think it's that simple.
Hey, could I ask, Steve, I know you're in California, but you blog on Powerline. James is right there in Minneapolis. What the heck is the latest on Franken? The governor appointed somebody to replace him, but Franken is still in the Senate. And just more generally, I wouldn't want a long discursion on this, but we've got 2018 coming up. Is there any hope that Minnesota will elect a Republican to any office at any level? Steve?
Well, I mean, I should defer to James, but I mean, I visit now and then. I visit my two riding partners, John and Scott, there. And look, you know, Trump almost won Minnesota. It was almost as close as it was back in the Reagan elections in the 80s. I always like to point out that Minnesota is the only state in the country that never voted for Ronald Reagan even once, which is a permanent stain on its legacy, I think. But look, Republicans have a slight majority in the state legislature, and the state is close. It's turning purple, I think. Now, next year may be tough, but you'll have two Senate races when Amy Klobuchar is up again for a regular term, and then Franken's seat, the remainder of it, will be filled. So two Senate races and a governor's race. And so I think it's going to turn out.
That's all in 2018?
Yes, next year. Right.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, so that's a trifecta. That's the whole thing.
It's going to be a Super Bowl.
James, what do you think?
That's going to be rocking. It will be a Super Bowl, and we're having the Super Bowl, by the way. I can't wait. I have my credentials to go, and I dreamed last night that I tried to walk through the front door of the Super Bowl without my credentials, and a security guard who left our newspaper 5 years ago stood up and said, no, just no. So I'm already having anxiety dreams about what that's going to be like. But when it comes to the other races, yeah, purple is, I think, where we're going. And even though there's been a bumpy ride with President Trump, there's still the cultural divide that exists between the metro and outstate is still there, right down to the fact that I call it outstate when the people who live there certainly don't call themselves outstate. They're Minnesota. But the mindset is the cities, good and liberal folk doing the right thing, and then a largely forgotten swath of people out there who do not share the same cultural values and, you know, want things like jobs in mines that the progressives in the cities don't let them have because mines are smelly and nasty. Okay.
Go ahead, James. Raised a point I want to ask Steve about, but go ahead.
No, that's it. Ask Steve.
Oh, okay. So
ask the guy in California about Minnesota.
This is a kind of permanent theme, and it's a podcast in itself. So I'm not inviting you, Steve, to spend 45 minutes giving us. But James just talked about upstate versus the cities. I grew up in New York State, where it was upstate versus downstate. And here in California, it's the coast, which means the urban, heavily settled area, Northern California and Los Angeles, versus the interior. What is it about cities that leads them so predictably to lean to the left? And what is it about the countryside, about rural and small town and midtown America, that causes it to lean in the other direction? It is a permanent pattern. How come?
Oh, my goodness. You said you didn't want a 45-minute dissertation.
Yeah, I know. It's hard, isn't it? That's
well,
hard.
Well, I mean, the answer to that really could go back to the argument between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, which I won't rehearse now. But remember, Jefferson hated banks and hated cities. Yep. And, you know, he thought it would be bad for human character because people who lived in cities would be dependent on their employers and the manufacturers and the bankers. And, I mean, there's more to it than that, of course. But another explanation I always liked was the late Ed Banfield, the great Harvard social scientist, who liked to point out, why are people friendly in small towns and curt and abrupt in New York? You know, the old stereotypes about walking down the street in New York,
sure.
Right?
And by the way, the stereotypes are true.
Exactly. And the reason is you don't have time in New York. What if you actually stopped to answer the question, how are you doing, to somebody in New York? You wouldn't get anywhere. That's a little sort of superficial social thing, but the friendliness of small towns based on their lower density and the fact that we all know each other, I think changes the politics of them. When you get a cultural divide going with the cultural elites in Hollywood and the media and on the coast sneering at the people who live in rural Alabama or rural Minnesota,
right.
People after a while don't like that and they notice it.
Mm-hmm. It's also self-selecting. I mean, the people who want to participate in a collective enterprise flock to the cities. The people who want a looser form of community that gives distance between people stay where they are or move to the rural areas. And once the people go to the cities, they want to intensify those values of collectivism and density and the rest of it. And while that was once a good idea, because it helps to build these magnificent things that we have in America called cities, nowadays it leads to all kinds of curious ideas about how society should be ordered that really do affect the way people live. All you have to do is to sit in traffic watching the cars just crawl along while an empty bike lane in the winter sits unused for 15, 20 blocks. All you have to do to see neighborhoods trying to look at ways to rezone, to put in denser housing where there's now single family, you see the new urbanist ideas that want to get people out of their houses, out of their cars, and into various collective means for living, be it the dense unit or the massive mass transit or the rest of it. And so what used to be cities great, rural great, each has their style. Now we're getting more of an idea of this perfect European city, which is nonsense. There's no way you can pattern an American city after a European model. It isn't going to work, and the American character doesn't fit to it. But they like it, and we're going to get it. But you're right. I mean, it's the values. I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, which had 50,000 people, which some people probably regard as you know, as small town America.
But it was the big town in North Dakota.
For North Dakota, that was it was the big city. Wait, yeah, well, there's Grand Forks and Bismarck, but that's Hickburgs. And you know, and now Fargo is twice the size and cosmopolitan, but it's still regarded out there as just a flyover speck. The country is dotted with is just a profusion of these small towns, 100,000, 50,000, 20,000, hanging along the arteries and the capillaries of America, and that is the feeder system for our strength and our character. The big city produces. What? It produces, you know, libertinism. It's artistic. It produces money and all these things. But you, the idea that somehow that these flyover values have to be, you're right, mocked at and sneered because they inevitably produce a Roy Moore. Well, they don't. They don't. And Minnesota, I think there's lots of communities happy to tell you that it's not the Roy Moore, the Bible thumping, get them gays out of here values that they embrace. What they embrace is something else, and it has to do more with economic populism. So we'll see. But, you know, Stephen, you mentioned that it could take a 45-minute ride or read to answer Peter's questions. What if you don't have that much time? What if you don't? What if you've got like 5-10 minutes or so, and you got to find something to read now, and all you have is your phone or your pad? Well, that's where you go to Blinkist, and I'm going to stop there because Stephen likes it when I do segues, so I did one just for him.
I saw it coming.
Okay. Segue moratorium temporary lifted on his behalf. I wanted to tell you about Blinkist, though, the Blinkist app. It's got over 2,000 of the best-selling nonfiction books transformed into powerful little packs you can read in just 15 minutes. Since you are listening to this podcast, obviously you love the idea of learning on the go, too, with your smartphone, with your tablet. Imagine if you could listen to the key insights of a nonfiction book written in just 15 minutes. Now, with Blinkist, you can. You can feast your mind on the key ideas from the top best-selling nonfiction books such as The Power of Habit, The 7 Habits of Highly Successful People, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and many others you've heard of and been wanting to read, but you've never made the time for. Well, if you're reading, just reading, maybe you'll get through one book a week if you're lucky. But with the Blinkist app, you get the key insights from 2 to 3 books on your way home. Blinkist gives you more knowledge in less time. That's because with Blinkist, you get the big ideas in small packages. Now, learn the essential ideas from the best books in your field, covering topics like productivity, business science, self-improvement, and you can uncover subjects you didn't even know that you loved. Their team of experts, you see, is constantly curating and adding new titles from the best of lists, so you know you're always getting the most powerful ideas distilled so that you can hear them in just 15 minutes or less in a made-for-mobile format. Blinkist was chosen by Apple and Google's best of selection for 2 years, and the app is used by over 3 million users. Wow. They will be helping you to be by your best by getting better trained, better informed, in less time than you ever imagined possible. And by the way, I mentioned The Power of Habit. That's a good one to read because you may think habit is what's keeping you down. Habit is what's riding you on rails in a trough. No, this book will give you the 7 habits of highly successful people. And it's not a Reader's Digest thing where you get 4 of them or 5. No, you get all 7. So right now, Blinkist has a specific offer for you, our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/ricochet right now and start your free trial to get 3 months off your yearly plan when you join today, which you will, right? That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/ricochet to start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan. Blinkist.com/ricochet. And now we go to a guest that we love to have back on, and she's been writing. Man, has she been writing. When Claire posts, shall we say, and she's got a book coming too. But one of the reasons we want to have her on is because she wrote an article about our current panic and to her surprise, was not roasted alive entirely on the internet for it. Claire Berlinski, she's a former Ricochet doyen and a freelance journalist who lives in Paris. She's crowdfunding a book about European politics, Brave Old World, portions of which we have seen on Ricochet. We're lucky. She'd be grateful for your support, by the way, so check out that link when you see her spot on the page. Claire, welcome. Tell us about the Warlock Hunt.
Thank you very much. Thank you also for pointing out that people can click on that link to donate money to my campaign. I have really appreciated that. This has been one of the really strange things that has ever happened to me in my publishing career. I had no idea that was going to happen. I began as a Facebook post, not even a Facebook post, began an answer on a friend's Facebook page. He posted something anodyne saying, has this gone too far? And his female friends attacked him en masse. It was like seeing some sort of ravening animals running down a slope toward an ibex or something. And I just felt they weren't saying totally sane things. I just, the tone of it really unnerved me, because there was something in it, and the language they were using, it was kill the kulaks sort of stuff. It was Rwandan radio stuff. It didn't sound right to me. It didn't sound healthy to me. And I began looking at these cases more closely. I've written about them on Ricochet before, actually. Do you remember the piece I wrote about Jeff Marcy, the astrophysicist?
The guy with the shirt.
No, I don't think it's his shirt. That was different. No, this is a guy at Berkeley who is in the running for the Nobel Prize, loaded up with federal funding, and got caught up in one of these scandals. No one knows really what happened or what didn't happen, but without due process, without any kind of trial, he found himself out of a job and out of billions of dollars of federal funding, I mean, which is not easily replaced because the research he was doing is irreplaceable. I wrote that in Ricochet a while ago, and that was a basis for what I wrote here. Something is going on now that is very, very strange, and it goes beyond social justice warriors. It goes beyond feminism. It goes beyond... It's a hysteria and a panic that has deep, deep roots that I don't really pretend to understand, but I can sure see that something's not right.
Claire, Peter here.
Yeah.
Welcome back. Could I just quote one sentence and ask you to expound upon it?
Mm-hmm.
This is Claire in The Warlock Hunt. Quote, in recent weeks, I've acquired new powers. Close quote. Explain.
Yeah, I bet every woman in the world has been thinking about this. I've been thinking about all these casual, flirtatious interchanges that I've had with coworkers or supervisors in one context or another. The kind of interchanges that say, hey, we're human. Hey, we can be comfortable. We can be relaxed about each other. Go up for a bar, you say something you wouldn't say if you hadn't had a couple of drinks. You're on a long assignment together where you spend a lot of time together. You start talking in a more frank language. You start talking, you're gossiping about other people at the office. You say things that would not look great in a deposition. And this is so human, right? I mean, anyone who doesn't recognize what I'm saying has never had a real job, has never earned a living, I think. I mean, if that's not the way you think it goes, then you don't know much about the real workforce.
Claire, you've got three men on the line with you. We're all nodding, but we're afraid to agree out loud.
Well, this is what's really freaking me out. Every man knows it. Every woman knows it. Now, you started with that quote and thought about the powers I now have. The power I now have is this. If I were to be swept up by this hysteria, if I were to look at all these women who are coming forward and suddenly have a change of heart, suddenly reevaluate my entire life in terms of this and realize that, no, actually, that wasn't fun, flirtatious, amusing or whatever, or normal or human and God bless them or whatever, but really a symptom of an entire culture that is so degrading and disgraceful for women that only now do I understand how humiliating it is. If I were to look over my life like that and think about them like that and and wind myself up thinking, no, that wasn't funny. That was degrading. And some women are doing just that. I could destroy them.
Well, there was an
destroy them.
I heard yesterday.
And I shouldn't be able to do that.
I heard yesterday about a professor who was going to lose everything, probably job, academic respect, because somebody had come forward long after the event, and there was no touching, there was no grabbing, there was no sad wanking, there was no cornering somebody in an elevator. There
did
was
you
a
say
comment
that on Ricochet podcast.
I did. I just did. I did.
Ixnay. Ixnay. No, I'm gonna faint.
And there, take to the couch, Claire. what he had said, he had complimented the woman's voice. Because apparently it was distinctive or low, or it had a Suzanne Plachette quality he found licorice or whatever, and she felt uncomfortable about it. So we've gone from the Weinsteins of the world, who are monsters, as Selma Hayek just reported to us, to the whole panoply of men with their sad, unwanted behavior that involve actual assault. But now we've tipped into something that if simply a woman feels uncomfortable in retrospect,
if she says, I feel demeaned, I felt humiliated, I froze, I was terrified, I went home and shook, I had no idea what to do. Any of these common phrases tacked at the end of some interchange that is either sexual or maybe sexual, or you know, something that didn't go, maybe it was funny at the time or maybe it wasn't quite so funny at the time, that's enough to ruin someone's life now.
But doesn't the end effect of that make women seem not like strong creatures who are standing up and saying me too, but incredibly fragile.
This is why I'm going absolutely, well, if you're allowed to say wank, I'm going to say batshit. I'm going to absolutely batshit because I cannot see what good women are doing for themselves with this. They are going, and the obvious implication of this, anyone with their head screwed on straight is going to see that any man with a reasonable instinct for self-preservation is not going to want women around the office place. And although he's not going to be able to have that, he's going to make sure that he is never in a position alone with a woman, is never going to have the kind of informal relationships with women that are essential to their professional advancement. You know, networking. What is networking about? Networking is about going out to lunch one-on-one. You don't go out to lunch one-on-one with a woman you're afraid who's going to drop a dime on you.
And if anybody doubts this, all you have to do is ask yourself, how many men are there in the daycare business right now?
Right. Let me bring something else up, though, because I don't know how much time we're going to have to talk about it. In the wake of my publishing this article, I've received hundreds of letters, hundreds, and I can't tell you who they're from for obvious reasons, but if you read them together, you'd weep. You really would. Something is so wrong here. We have men whose careers – I mean, obviously, I'm not taking them all at face value. Probably some of them are telling them the truth, and some are embellishing the truth, and some are remembering it the way they want to. But they're too similar in language for me not to believe that basically what's going on is roughly what they're telling me. No accusers to confront. They don't even know what they're being accused of. HR investigators who surreptitiously go around behind their backs asking everyone in a leading way, did such and such do something that made you uncomfortable, with the presumption being that you would be telling them something they wanted to hear.
Right.
If you said, oh, yeah, he did make me uncomfortable, maybe when he chewed, you know, that popcorn with his mouth open, whatever. But something going on that it should not be happening in a free society, resulting in the destruction of their lives, but not just this destruction, but this form of aggressive, voyeuristic humiliation where every single detail of their sexual life is publicized in the New York Times, things that no one has a right to know about them. And even if you're going to write an article about sexual harassment, do you need to know the details about, oh, I'm not going to say who it is, people who read the article will know who it is, about so-and-so having sex on his desk with his assistant? I mean, that's not anyone's business. It's just not anyone's business. It's a grotesque national voyeurism that we're all entrapped in. And when I think about the details of my sex life or my sexual foibles being broadcast, primetime news over everything, along with the accusation that I was something below a creep, something below immoral, but some kind of monster. I think I'd want to die, and I have a feeling some of these men will commit suicide because that is the kind of event that if you're not in great emotional health to begin with, that can precipitate an act of tremendous self-destruction.
You know, Stephen Hayward is quite quiet here. Stephen, well, is there?
First of all, I've been bolded to say what would otherwise risk my career by saying I've long had this mad fanboy crush on Claire Berlinski, even though we've never met. So I say you can't say that now without, right?
Fun is this for women? Tell me why this is an advance for women. Don't you think we enjoy hearing that? Don't you think we like that?
Right. Right. Just one
thing. Am I happier because I didn't know that my work and my persona were admired? No, of course not. What a dull, dreary world we'd be living in if no one complimented anyone else and no one. We are going toward that world, though, where right. people are afraid even to sort of cutely flirt.
Yeah, quick comment. About 5 years back when I was an inmate at the University of Colorado, I got into a heap of trouble one day on Colorado Public Radio when I said, you know, both my mother and my mother-in-law, when they were in the workforce back in the 1940s, when we didn't have sexual harassment laws, we didn't have hostile workplace statutes, we didn't have human resources departments, and, you know, the lawyers they worked for, they both worked for lawyers, would pinch them on the bottom or grab their knee. And both my mother-in-law and mother said, what we found was, if you just slap them once real hard, the problem was solved. And so I said this on the radio, and all hell broke loose. I mean, there was a faculty senate wanted to drum me out of the university for recommending assault. And so that's where we are. The question I want to ask is
– it's a national insanity. I mean, it's just complete hysteria.
Yeah, that's what the question I want to ask is, how are we going to get out of all this? I mean, you compare this to the Salem witch trial mania and some other things, and other people have compared it to McCarthyism. Where, again, it's a complicated matter. We had real communists, but McCarthy was reckless, and people are being reckless now.
Yeah, McCarthy didn't happen to have access to the Venona tapes, revelation that would have proved him right. He happened to just be a nut who happened to get it right.
But you know how that ended, as people know, is really two things. Eisenhower sort of undermined him subtly, and then you had that climactic moment when Joseph Welch said, "Have you no shame?" on the Senate floor, and then he was censured, and you know he sort of self-destructed and went away. And so I'm wondering if you have any idea how this is going to end, or is there going to be more people like you?
I can say this: there is a known trajectory of a moral panic, right? I mean, this is not a new phenomenon. It's very studied by sociologists. So yes, it has an end, and usually ends with some kind of more concrete resolution about what Cohn called the boundary crisis. I thought his insight was very relevant here. We are having a boundary crisis because right now no one really knows what the boundaries are for sexual behavior in the workplace or out of the workplace. We've just been through a total upheaval in the form of the sexual revolution, in the form of the mass entry of women into the workplace, in the form of the transformation of our economy to one that is much more favorable to women.
Go back and explain who Cohn is and what the boundary argument is. You're presuming knowledge of that I think many listeners won't have.
All right. Yeah. What I brought up in the last part of the article, if you made it all the way through, and brought up because my editor, Adam Garfinkel, said it really needs this, and he was right, was he said, okay, but why this panic? Why now? And I started thinking about it, and I started thinking about a book by Stanley Cohn, who he wrote about the mods and the rockers in Britain, called Moral Panics and Folk Devils. And he is the classic criminological and sociological study of the cycle of a moral panic, and one in which a folk devil is identified by the media, and its significance, it's something that signifies a real problem. There's something really there. There's something that bothers people. I mean, it begins with Weinstein, and yeah, that bothers people for a damn good reason, right? But suddenly the folk devil is exaggerated hysterically to the point where no one can have a rational conversation about the subject anymore. And then you get what he calls the moral entrepreneurs who compete with each other to show their own respectability by decrying the folk devil. Have we seen this phenomenon so far? We have. Yes, right? Mm-hmm. And the problem becomes exacerbated rather than remediated because people can't talk rationally about it anymore. Because I mean, everyone so far on this call is that I can't say this except to you. That's not a joke. People can't talk rationally about this anymore. They can't ask each other, so what are the boundaries here? They just can't. And sooner or later, after a lot of witch hunting is done, a lot of men's lives are destroyed, and they really are destroyed. It's a deep injustice. It's a terrible thing that I'm getting letters from men who who are using a vocabulary that no man in a free society should be so fluent with. And I, you know, maybe some of them aren't innocent, but I have a suspicion quite a few of them are.
You mentioned the Mods and the Rockers. That was a later version of what happened in America when we had a panic over juvenile delinquency. I mean, it had its own manifestation in two different social, you know, two different styles, greasers, different kinds of music. But in America in the 50s, we feared the JD. We feared the guy with the switchblade and the greased up hair and the rest of it. The difference was, in that moral panic, was eventually the culture, the counterculture, the intellectuals began to side with the juvenile delinquency because they saw in his nihilism an essential fact about modern life. And so they began by using these archetypes that went against the current bourgeois society to devolve and deconstruct and eliminate all the usual rules by which people behaved. And that has led us to where we are now. So the ultimate result of the sexual revolution, which was supposedly going to be the empowerment of everybody, turns out to have been the empowerment of creeps and a slew of conflicts for women, which were still working out. And the end result where everyone's walking around now on eggshells. You said, I don't know how people, you know, how do people behave? I know how to behave in the office. I mean, it's not that hard to be a reasonable gentleman. It isn't. But, you know, I pity young women and young men coming up and not knowing whether or not they need
especially pity shy young men coming up in this environment. Shy men who are already totally bulked up by what it is that what women want, who are now thinking, and on top of it, if I get my attempt to approach her wrong, I'm going to wind up in HR. I'm going to lose my job. This is a terrible environment for them, and it's not helping our overall national morale. It's not helping, and I'm sure it's related to the epidemic of suicide and deaths of despair, as they call them. This is not healthy. It really isn't. But to put it on a more healthy footing, I think we're going to have to begin to look at this in a much more rational way. We're going to have to say there are aspects of the world as it used to be that we clearly miss. And we need to bring back replacement structures, even if we don't want all of that world. We need to set really clear guidelines about workplace behavior, certainly. They may be totally new guidelines. We can't punish men for not knowing those guidelines in 1979, however. I mean, we really cannot. That is absolutely immoral. But what I think has come up, what is clear, is that many women are furious about the way they've been treated in the workplace. Many men are baffled. And so we need absolutely foolproof guidelines for behavior in the workplace, even if they're ridiculous, even if they're like the campus rape codes where you have to ask me, please put my finger on your on your arm before touching you, to keep women and men safe. And I think we also have to think about this in deeper terms, though, in deeper psychological terms, how it is that we are so angry at each other, women at men and men at women. Women are acting out an anger that seems so disproportionate. Where's that from? Who's that really meant for? Can't be these poor schmucks.
And what is the answer? What is your answer? Have you got a provisional answer? Or are you?
Hey, this is some world. I mean, you know, Freud asked, "What we want?" But I am so struck by the anger. I have a lot of ideas going through my head. I don't know whether they make sense yet. I think about, you know, the divorce epidemic of the 1970s, right, and think about how many women were left without a father figure.
So, who they trust. Claire, may I try a provisional answer on you?
Sure.
The sexual revolution turned out to be a really bad deal for women.
Yeah, except not every all. Not all of it was.
Okay.
It really wasn't. I mean, okay. I think the idea that women should be in control of how many children they want to have and whether they want to have a career that they can do, whether they should have as many opportunities in the workplace as a man, is those were great ideas. The fact that I had tutorials one-on-one with dons at Balliol was fantastic. And when you talk about rolling back the sexual revolution, you talk about rolling back that back too.
Mm. You do? Those are necessarily tied to,
yes, because
to co-ed dorms on every campus. What's that?
Well, I don't know about co-ed dorms, but they are precisely tied to that. The argument against admitting women to Balliol is that this is just a bad idea to have men and women unsupervised in a room alone together. That's just inappropriate.
Hmm.
Claire, it's Steve Hayward again. In a little bit of time we have left, I wonder if we could briefly ask you about two other things.
Sure.
One is, I don't keep as close a track of what's going on in France as I should, and when I do, I'm not sure I get the whole picture. But, I mean, the country has essentially been almost under martial law. I understand posted. No, is that too strong? Okay.
The country's been appropriately policed given the level of the terrorist threat.
Well, okay. Well, I guess I'll put the question broadly this way. What's
state
the
of emergency.
Current state of emergency? Okay.
Yeah,
what's
that's the legal
what's the current state of sort of anti-Semitism in France, relative to, I don't know, I'm not sure what. But
you know, I saw some screaming headline on the front of Drudge and traced it back to Breitbart. And then don't trust those things because this is really weird. Every couple of years, there's anti-Semitism in France hysteria that happens in the United States. I don't know why. It's an interesting phenomenon. I should track it. Every couple of years, it starts. You see these screaming headlines in the U.S. that the Jews are fleeing France, and I looked at the statistics, and no, they're not. The incidence of anti-Semitic anti-Semitic incidents, as the government defines them, and it defines them quite precisely, has actually decreased by 20% last year. So, you know, if they're fleeing, they're not fleeing because of that.
Go ahead.
And the government does keep very close track. I mean, they will define something like the writing of a swastika on a metro wall as an anti-Semitic crime. And it's gone down, both casual and more serious anti-Semitic crimes. And so there is – if Jews are fleeing – that's not why they're fleeing. Now, it is entirely possible that we're seeing socioeconomic mobility that is taking Jews from certain neighborhoods that have now become more Muslim and moving them and moving them to neighborhoods that are known for their higher socioeconomic status.
Right. And one other quick question is, can you give us a hot take on Macron? Is he actually kind of more interesting than we might have thought? I mean, I thought he was just another Davos man, but I see signals that maybe he is better than that.
Oh, well, that's the question we're all asking. Is he another Davos man or is he more interesting? And it depends what he can pull off. So far, I think what's been remarkable is that he did manage to come out of nowhere, destroy both of France's established political parties, place himself in the center and say, well, now I'm going to change French labor laws and do it. Now, that doesn't happen that often.
Right.
So I'm inclined to be pretty impressed by him. But he's got some big problems to work with and a lot of big figures to work with, too. He's going to have to work with Merkel and he's going to have to work with the rest of the EU and he's going to have to work with Putin and he's going to have to work with Trump. And somehow his vision of France, if his vision of France is at the end of this, the vision he has in mind now, I will be very impressed because that's a very challenging project. But so far, I have been impressed.
All right, everybody, you can go to any magazine site in the country and read about people in America talking about Europe, or you can go to Ricochet, look at Claire's posts, and find out what an American in Europe is writing about Europe, and support her book too, because we want to see that. Based on the excerpts that we've seen, it's going to be spectacular and as engaging and interesting as everything else that Claire has done. Thanks for joining
us
today.
It was my pleasure.
Don't be a stranger for so long.
I am not a stranger.
And pity me, your host, because after this long discussion of all the difficulties that people have in this sexually charged world, I have to do a mattress commercial.
Oh, lucky you.
That may be the greatest segue ever.
Want me to do it in a really sexy tone of voice?
Could you just
send me a text. I'll do it for you.
All right. Thanks,
Claire. I'll do your mattress.
Right, Claire. Apart from anything else, give our best to your dad too, will you please?
Yeah. I sure will.
All right, great.
Au revoir,
guys.
Thank you. And I'm serious because people do need to sleep. Sleep chastely, might I add. But however you wish to sleep, take it from me, you're going to get the best sleep on a Casper. It's the brand that continues to revolutionize the sleep industry with a line of products that creates an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. Casper mattresses provide all the support the human body needs, craves in all the right places. And after all, you spend a third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable, right? Of course. Well, Casper brand mattresses combine multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with just the right amount of sink and bounce. And if you don't know what that means, you will understand the minute you flop and drop into a Casper. Three mattress models available, the original Casper, the Wave, and the Essential. Now, they're not just a mattress company. No. They offer a wide variety of products to ensure an overall better sleep experience. Casper can offer you these affordable prices because why? Altogether now, they cut out the middleman and they sell directly to you, the consumer. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper, Amazon, Google, they're becoming the internet's favorite mattress, and you can help. They're designed, developed, and assembled in the United States, which is great. Go U.S., and they offer no hassle returns if you're not completely satisfied. It will be delivered right to your door in this amazing box. It makes you ask, how did they get it in there? Patented technology, I'm sure. Free shipping, free returns in the U.S. and Canada, and you can be sure of your purchase with a 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. So I've been sleeping on one of these things for a couple of years now, and did I mention before that I like to take a nap? Yeah, one of the reasons that I haven't gotten the Christmas cards out is because it comes to a certain time of the day when I should be putting out the cards, but the Casper beckons with its siren song of comfort, and off I go. So you can be like me. Lazy? No. Or you can be like me, somebody who just wants to get up and face the day with new strength and energy because you slept on a Casper. $50 off this mattress purchase, which you will want to make by going to Casper.com/ricochet and use the promo code Ricochet. Once again, that's Casper.com/ricochet. Promo code Ricochet for $50 off any mattress. Terms and conditions apply. And our thanks to Casper for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Well, gentlemen, before we go, we have many things else to discuss. It's the usual bounteous week of news. Good Lord. A lot of people were hammering National Review the last couple of days for an editorial saying it's time to investigate the investigators. A lot of despair among some people on the right saying that National Review has now given in to the worst forms of Trumpism by saying there might be something a little suspect on Mueller's team. What say you guys?
Yeah, I would like to hear what Steve has to say about this. I watched got done with my desk work last night and spent a few moments watching Fox. And there was Newt Gingrich saying that don't fire Mueller, but the FBI and possibly the Department of Justice both need to be investigated themselves. And I'd like to hear what Steve has to say about that.
Yeah, well, this, you know, we said before that on the city question, we could go back to Jefferson. On this one, you can go all the way back to Plato, who said, who's going to watch the watchers, right?
Right.
And, you know, our fellow Ricochet podcaster, Andrew Clavin, has been making jokes about this for weeks now about we need an investigation of the investigation and investigators for the investigation. Right. He's very good, very funny about all that. But look, you know, these texts that came out from that agent Straws, or however you pronounce the name, is really problematic.
Who is he? Set
well,
it up.
The fellow, yeah, sorry, that's right. He was the agent who worked on the Hillary investigation and who I think most substantially persuaded James Comey to change his wording from gross negligence, which meant a crime, to extremely careless about her handling of her private server, right, back in July a year ago. But he had apparently he had a mistress, another FBI agent, to whom he had 10,000 text messages. I mean, were they doing any work at all? I mean, this is ridiculous. And some of them are pretty salacious. One of them talked about how, I'll paraphrase here, I don't remember the exact word, I don't have it in front of me, but it was, we can't allow Trump to become president. I don't think there's any chance he'll win. But just in case, we better have some kind of plan B in place. I'm not sure he used plan B, but it was language to that effect. And you sort of wonder, what did that mean? Did that mean the Steele dossier or, you know, leaks and, you know, helping to gin up this Russia collusion story? And the broader problem is this. You know, the phrase that's become very popular in the last 6-8 months is the deep state. And
right.
I've been a little I've had mixed feelings about this because the more technical term that our friends like Richard Epstein and, you know, friends at Hoover know is the administrative state, which talks about the constitutional problems we have with runaway administrative government. And the deep state has become the shorthand, more popular version of that. But it's not quite the same thing. This FBI problem really is, I think, an example of what is meant by the deep state, in that you have agencies and people in agencies who think they have a permanent interest, immune from politics, immune from the will of the voters,
exactly.
And believe it of their own will, they can take it upon themselves to rule that a duly elected president is illegitimate and should be driven from office. And that is a big problem. And I'll end with this. I've never gone for these deep dish conspiracies, but, you know, there's always been thought that one part of the Watergate story 40 years ago was the intelligence community and the FBI saying we're in on it to get rid of Nixon. And
right.
I think there's something to all that. That doesn't exonerate Nixon.
By the way, we now know that that was true. Deep Throat was Mark Felt, who was the number two at the FBI, and he was leaking to Woodward and Bernstein. We now know that it was for aggrieved. He was professionally aggrieved. He felt he should have been named director of the FBI after Hoover left. And out of his own personal bitterness, he brought down Richard Nixon. Now, that is not to defend Richard Nixon, but the high-ranking agent at the FBI was involved in bringing down the president. We now know to be true. We also know this, that there is a legitimate question about whether the Trump dossier, which we now know is unsubstantiated and was paid for very substantially by the Democratic, by the Hillary, I guess it was the Democratic National Committee, in any event, by some official organ of the Democratic Party. The question is whether that Trump dossier was used as the basis for a request from a warrant, for a warrant from the FISA court to eavesdrop on Americans, including members of the Trump campaign. That is to say, the FBI used phony information to manipulate a court into permitting it to eavesdrop on the opponents of the Democratic Party. And we now know people that high-ranking candidacy that high-ranking FBI officials disdained themselves.
Or as Andy McCarthy says, might be more plausible, that the first run with the Fusion GPS dossier got them nowhere. So what they brought to them later was information that they had substantiated based on the leads that they saw from the document.
What we have right now is the duly elected representatives of the American people through the House Select Committee on Intelligence has requested information about this subpoenaed documents. And the FBI and the Justice Department have stonewalled that committee again and again and again for a period now of months. Article 1 of the Constitution establishes Congress, not the FBI. And so what we have shaping up right now is a direct defiance of the constitutional order by the FBI. That is an outrage, and it's serious, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, no, I think the whole thing stinks. And I mean, and I think it's going to damage the FBI very badly. I think what's going to happen is we're going to find out there was something of a cabal inside the FBI that was, you know, pro-Hillary and somehow insinuated themselves into the center of this. And I think it's going to damage a lot of people at the FBI I've met Mueller once about 10 years ago in the company of a very prominent Reaganite conservative. So I don't know quite what his own personal political leanings are, but my first blush was I was kind of hopeful about the guy only because he knows good friends of mine. And I'll mention that, one of my privileges in life was knowing a very senior FBI man. He was on the team that arrested Aldrich Ames way back when. And I've never met a finer human being than this particular guy. And by the way, he and his wife, who also an agent, were very conservative politically. So, right. You know, this is a problem. Who knows what the FBI is like on across the broad spectrum. But there's a serious problem with what went wrong here.
If you're assembling in a team, though, don't you have a lot of people to choose from? And if you choose somebody who themselves has had a partisan moment before that you know about or was involved in the, deposing Hillary, it seems like maybe you could go outside of that little group. Unless, of course, you're trying to keep the old cabal together because everybody's on the same page and you know where it's going. What I find, I mean, we'll find out eventually, I hope. Let all the poisons in the mud hatch out, as I, Claudia, said. But what I find odd is the absolute lack of interest on this on people in the
yes.
press because
yes.
I mean I know that they're invested in Trump is going to go down because of the Russia thing, but it's entirely possible to have two ideas in your head proceeding in the same direction like train tracks, but yet this thing, which smacks of everything that the left loves when it's talking about conspiratorial government and the evil cabals that bring down the good guys. This is huge if it's true. This is immense, but it doesn't play. It doesn't fire five synapses when I talk to people. It's just, they just shrug and it doesn't matter.
for some reason in their heads, it's all every time you bring up this, you know, the deposition of Hillary and the downgrading of her server, you know, they get sort of a little smile on their face and say, but her emails, because they've factored her emails into complete and utter irrelevance. That was never anything that meant anything. And likely they feel the same way about this, that at best it was justified. At worst, you know, it happens. So, I mean, it's extraordinary to me. But they're consumed with Russia. Absolutely. So they put all of their eggs in that basket. And their eggs, as a matter of fact, if they put them in an away travel suitcase, would probably survive the entire journey intact, no matter how much the plane was bumped around. Because
I saw that coming. Piece of
potato. I didn't. I didn't see it coming, but I have to do it. But I want to do it anyway because I love to travel. I didn't used to, but I do now. But one of the things that makes travel even greater for me is knowing that I can walk through the airport spinning with the greatest of ease, almost in a balletic fashion, my away travel suitcase. They use high quality materials that offer me a much lower price compared to the other brands by cutting out that middleman and selling directly to you. Now, there are a variety of colors and their sizes. There's the carry-on. There's the bigger carry-on. There's the medium and the large for the extended stay, or the kids carry-on. All suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate, unrivaled in strength and impact resistance, and they're very lightweight, by the way. The interior, it's great. It features a patent-pending compression system. It's very helpful for those of you who overpack or who buy a few too many things on your trip. Four 360-degree spinner wheels, which guarantee a smooth ride. TSA-approved combination lock built right into the top of the bag to keep people from going through your stuff. Removable, washable laundry bags to keep the dirty clothes separate from the clean. Here's my favorite part. Both sizes of the carry-on are able to charge cell phones, tablets, e-readers, anything else that's powered with a USB cord. There's a battery in it. I love it. A single charge of the away carry-on will charge your iPhone 5 times. So if you're stuck in an airport, your flight's been canceled, everybody's got the outlets camped on, you can charge at your leisure. Lifetime warranty. If anything breaks, they'll fix it, replace it for you for life. 100-day trial. Live with it, vibe with it, travel with it, Instagram it. If at any point you decide, it's not for me, what's the matter with you if it isn't? You can return it for a full refund, no questions asked. Free shipping on any away order within the lower 48. Remember, away bags and accessories make the perfect gift with a lifetime guarantee and the 100-day free trial. So, you know, there's a perfect size and color for anybody on your list this holiday season. Act now, or just grab an away gift card if you can't make up your mind. They will. As I say, I love my away. I look forward to traveling, and sometimes I'm glad that it's a long trip because I can bring the really big one. And that one, I can get weeks of travel in that. So $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/ricochet20. Use the promo code ricochet20 during the checkout. Once more, that's awaytravel.com/ricochet20. Promo code 20 for checkout for $20 off any suitcase. And we thank Away Travel for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Well, before we go, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure the nation is still grappling with the fact that Omarosa is out of the White House. I'd forgotten that she was in. I didn't really know who she was. But once again, and I don't care about that, although she says she's going to tell some things because that's the third act of her particular career. But she said it said that she was removed by force, dragged out. And then came the reports from the Secret Service saying, no, that didn't happen. So who are we to believe here? Is this another example of that term that I've absolutely come to loathe, fake news?
James, there's only one thing worse on a podcast than saying, I don't know, but I'm about to say that thing that is worse. Uh-huh. I don't care.
There you go. Okay.
Oh, I don't care either, but I do have this observation. I've been observing for a while how many firsts Trump is delivering in our political scene. First person ever elected for whom the presidency was his first public service. The first president to have his scandal the very first year in office. Usually presidents wait till their second term to have a scandal or some kind of political difficulty. So Trump may be flipping a script and getting that out of the way early, which because I think this Russia thing is fizzling. And then third, the tell-all books usually don't appear until year 5 or 6 of a two-term presidency, right? And you think of, Don Regan and David Stockman back in 1987, 86. Or you think of Robert Rice with Locked in the Cabinet late in the Clinton years. And so Omarosa is going to be first out with the Trump book probably by Father's Day is my prediction, if not sooner. And so there we go. As I say, everything is being speeded up under Trump. And as I say, he may flip the script. And I still think despite all the things he does that drives me crazy, he may end up being a very successful and handily reelected president.
Ah. Well, we'll pin you to that. On the way out, last question is
Peter. Wait. Is there any way we can just make sure that that bit gets edited out of any versions that are listened to in Berkeley?
Probably a good idea, right?
We don't tailor these for different markets, Peter. We can't say that. Then people would think that the ricochet that they're listening to is not the ricochet that other people do. No, this is one undiluted stream of ricochet truth. Before we go, last question, as Peter Robinson is wont to say, on a cultural note, best movie you saw in 2017. Very easy for me, but I have the feeling that Peter maybe saw one, and that's the one he's going to name.
Well, I last week raved about Murder on the Orient Express, and that's still in my mind. We've also seen since then The Man Who Invented Christmas, which is a stinker from the first moment to the last, overwrought, overacted, and boring in spite of it all. Aside from Murder on the Orient Express, which I think it provided the most sheer, simple pleasure of any movie we saw in 2017, I think I would name Dunkirk. As long as immediately after seeing the movie, you read the column that Victor Davis Hanson wrote about Dunkirk, placing it in historical context and filling in the bits that the movie leaves out. But it is a remarkable piece of filmmaking. It is gripping from the first moment to the last. And if you place it in context by reading Victor, you'll be okay.
Now, Peter, I take it you haven't seen Darkest Hour yet.
No, I haven't seen it yet. No.
Yeah, okay. So that's my movie of the year.
Interesting because a lot, including your fellow Powerline blogger Scott Johnson, just panned it, I noticed.
Yes, well, instead of Kyle Smith, I'll just say this to tease everyone here, because otherwise it would take too long. I had to hold back from yelling at the screen while I was watching it, saying, that's wrong, no, this is wrong, and walking out of the theater thoroughly annoyed. But by the next morning, literally after tossing and turning all night thinking about it, I changed my mind, and I'm going to explain that at great length in an article. And now I think it's a great movie.
Well, the minute you post that article, you better send us the link, because now we and all our listeners are going to want to read it.
Yeah.
I'll give you my choice. But first, I want to tell you that this podcast has been brought to you by Aero, Casper, and Away Travel. Well, I mean, really, why you say that, people go away. They say, it's over, I'm done. But
You're right.
We also want to tell you to go to iTunes and leave a review. That would be nice, especially if you like it, because your reviews allow new listeners to find the show, and that keeps it going. And, of course, we advise you and beg you. No, we don't beg. That's demeaning. We strongly advise that you do the wise thing and spend $2.50 a month, which is nothing, to join the podcast listener tier. And you can comment and read stuff, too. It'll be a great introduction to Ricochet. And then you'll pay the huge $5 freight. Oh, that'll bust the bank. My favorite movie, and I didn't see many. I see most of them later on DVDs. But the theater experience that I enjoyed the most this year was last week with Coco, which is the Pixar film that I went to see with my daughter. And it is funny. It's wildly inventive. The Pixar sets a standard for these things that somehow you forget until you look at the ones that preceded in the trailers. There was a movie animated about garden gnomes, one of whom jumps in a mud puddle, and there is a series of flatulence. There was a trailer for Ferdinand the Bull, who's trying to escape very quietly, but unfortunately he too is plagued by flatulence. There was a movie about ducks, and ducks were in a truck, and a pig backed up on the bill, and the pig had an expression because the duck's bill was in his butt. That's most animated movies. And then on a whole different level of sophistication and intelligence and wit and heart is Pixar. And everybody, the reviewers, have said this strange thing. Well, not among Pixar's best. It certainly is a great... I'm sorry. You can make a very good argument that it isn't the best, and it's very difficult to look at everything that this movie does and say that it's number two for anything. It's a wonderful film. My daughter and I have gone to all of the Pixar movies since she was a little kid. It's been an annual tradition, and this is the last time that she's going to be at home, because next year she'll be gone. And we sat there. We watched the story about remembering and about family, and sat there until the credits were done. And the Luxow Look So Lamp bounced across the street and knocked the Pixar logo down and then turned to us and the light bulb went off. And then we left the theater. That's how we always did it. So even with that, even if I didn't have that experience, I'd put that one high up there. But for the two of us to have that last moment and for her to finally be crying at the end of a Pixar movie, I looked at her and said, welcome to adulthood, kid. Thank you, everybody, for listening. It's been a pleasure. Stephen, we'll talk to you later. Peter, we'll see you next week. And thanks to everybody for listening to Ricochet Podcast at Ricochet 3.0.
Join the conversation.